سلام علیکم و رحمت الله. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. الحمد لله رب العالمین و صلی الله علی محمد و آل محمد. First, I would like to thank the organizers and the committee and the members of this community for giving me this opportunity to share a few moments with you for the next few days, inshallah. In Islam, after over 14 centuries, one observes that many of the wisdoms of many rituals and rulings and articles of aqa'id, faith, are in the process of extinction. And the external superficial facade is left without any attentiveness to the batini, esoteric meaning of those rituals, rulings, or articles of faith. In relation to rulings, for example, eating with one's hands, many people do, but they don't know what the batini meaning behind it is. Or cutting or trimming one's nails on certain days, in certain places, in certain states, and in doing it under certain circumstances, many people may do, but they don't know what the meaning behind it is, and so on and so forth. I won't be going into detail in that respect. But when it comes to the status of women too, this has also been compromised. Since the time of the Ma'sumin to today, there's always been in addition to the Ahlul Dhahir, the people of the letter of religion, which is very important in fiqh, in theology, kalam, and so on and so forth. At the same time, there's always been the esoteric tradition too, the urafa, since the beginning. And then from generation to generation up to today, as the dhahiri tradition has persisted, and we all have access to it, the batini tradition also has persevered. But we don't have access to it, or we don't want to have access to it. But it's always been there. And al-dhahir, without attentiveness to the batini aspects of religion, is like a spiritless corpse, according to many scholars. And the reason why many of the wisdoms and why we feel lost sometimes in relation to many articles of faith, and we don't know why we do certain things, and then the youth may lose hope or motivation or incentive in relation to those things, is because we've lost the batini aspect to religion, and this has had an effect on the zahiri manifestation of religion. And one of those side effects is how we see the woman in Islam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Sorry, thank you.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
Status of women, their value, and how Islam sees the woman in the batini sense, these have become lost over time. Lost though amongst the people, the masses. However, the message has always been there.
since the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt and the tafsir and understanding and extrapolations that the Urafa had since that time until today. But people being people, they only want the zahir, and they don't pay heed to the batini aspects. And in the same way that the philosophy and wisdoms behind a lot of rituals that we do have become lost, the status of the woman has also been lost. And this has nothing to do with Islam. Islam has always been there, its rulings, its wisdoms. It's a reflection of the people. You get what you sow. And so if the status of the woman has been compromised, we only have to look at ourselves. Now I want to go through some aspects to the status of the women in how it's seen in Islam, and then by default the role of women in the social and spiritual aspects will become evident. And questions that may never have come to the fore or may never have been given access to come amongst the people will be addressed, and was addressed since long time ago. In relation to the tradition of the Holy Messenger, the prophetic tradition that says, حُبِّبَ إِلَيَّ مِن دُنْيَاكُمْ ثَلَاث. Three things have been assigned for me to love from your world. النِّسَاء, women. وَالتِّيب, aroma. وَجُعِلَ قُرَّةُ عَيْنِي السَّلَاة. And Salat has been assigned as the light of my eyes. This tradition has been available to the Ahlul Dahir and the Ahlul Batin. They've all seen this tradition. But how have they commentated upon this tradition? The tradition is from the Holy Messenger, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. However, each scientist pertaining to each science within Islam has given a commentary of it based on the principles of that given science. So when it comes to a faqih, you can't expect much save how the faqih, the jurisprudent, explains women based on jurisprudential principles. The faqih won't extend beyond his or her criteria or their standards. They speak as a faqih. Or the theologian comes across and approaches and encounters the question of woman based on their standards, theological principles, nothing beyond that. The philosopher according to his or her own. But when it comes to the Urafa, it's different now. They have their own principles, and they give a commentary of the same tradition through their own principles. So it doesn't matter, they all give a different outlook. That's natural in Islam. And they're all haq, and they're all truth, but to varying degrees of truth. So someone may come and give a very animalistic picture of the woman because they see the world in that manner and say that it's the animalistic dimension of the woman here that the Holy Prophet, it's been assigned for him to love. And no one is saying that's not true, but the truth is much higher than that. That's a small aspect of the tradition. But to suffice with that, you're limiting religion. There's something much more important embedded in this tradition. Ibn Arabi, one of the very famous Urafa of almost 1,000 years ago, he says, look, in this tradition, the woman has been stated horizontal to Salat. And in this tradition, the context does not show any hierarchy, that one is, this is first, this is second, and this is third. And when the woman is used and stated horizontal to Salat, they're used on equal pairing here. It's on a par with Salat. And in the same way that Salat is Mi'raj al-Mu'min, the ascension of the believer, and in the same way that Salat is a celestial Malakuti reality, here the woman also is a means of one's ascension to Allah, one's proximity to Allah, like Salat, and the woman too, in reality, is a celestial being, like Salat. And here we see things change all of a sudden. Secondly, the word Nisa is used, rather than Imra'a. They both mean women, but they're used in different contexts. Nisa in Arabic comes from Nasi'a, which means delaying. Why should the woman be addressed by a term in Arabic, in the Quran, which means delaying? It may seem medieval at first. And many of these traditions, when you first look at them, they may seem medieval, but the batini meaning is important. Lawla an-nisa la'ubidat. Or, yes, I can't remember that. I haven't written this tradition down. It just suddenly came to me. Lawla an-nisa la'ubidtu haqqan haqqa. I think that's the Arabic. That Allah says in this Hadith al-Qudsi, that if there were no women, I would have been worshipped truthfully the right way. This tradition too, it seems medieval. It even seems that it's going against women. And it will always seem like that if you have a Zahiri look on religion. The Zahir is accessible to all. The Batin you have to strive for. It's not given freely. The Jamali aspects of Allah give you the Zahir of everything. The Jamali, the beauty aspects of Allah. And that's why it's a free ride. Tabarakalladhi biyadihi mulk. Tabaraka, blessed is he. It's a Jamali attribute. But in whose hands is the mulk, the physical realm of existence, the zahiri realm of existence. Be you Muslim or non-Muslim, it's given to you. Allah doesn't limit it, doesn't suppress anyone. It's given to everyone, the mulki aspect. But when it comes to the malakut of things, Allah's Jalali attributes are at stake. His authority. His not allowing everyone a free ride. Subhanalladhi biyadihi malakutu kulli shay. Subhan is his Jalali attributes. If you want to get to the malakut, the batin, the inner dimension of things, of anything, yes, Allah's there to stop you. You have to strive for it. You have to endeavor. It's not a free ride. So these traditions, if you limit yourself to the zahir, you're going to have problems, and then you're going to question Islam. Why does Islam do this? Why does Islam say that? But if you attain access to the batini aspects, no. It will all fall in place, but you have to strive. Nisa means delaying. That's problematic at first. Why should the woman be a delayer? What is she delaying? You know, in banking transactions or buying and selling, in trade, we have something called a delayed payment. Where you buy something, but then you pay in a delayed fashion over time. So you want to buy a computer. If you want to buy it all together right now, it's $100. You don't have that, so you pay in installments, even though you know you'll pay $200 at the end of the installments. That's allowed in Islam, and it's called nasi'a. See, delayed payment. Nasi'a is a form of delayed payment that we have in Islam. It's allowed, but look, it comes from nasi'a, that delaying again. So do women. Here, the Urafa have treatises written on why Nisa is called Nisa, why women are delayers, or why they are called such. And these things haven't been published. And I'm acting with audacity here, being born and bred in the West, you know, we don't understand this keeping knowledge from people too much. Okay, some things maybe is best kept behind the closet or in the closet or behind the doors. But some things really the West has to know. And actually once I had a mentor, and whatever I would learn from him, I would come and give in the lectures. And then a student from the West made contact with the same mentor, just in passing. And then told the mentor that, yes, there's someone called Sekalishvara and he's giving this out in the West. That mentor stopped teaching me. They're very serious about this. It's not a game for them. When he found out that I'm giving this kind of knowledge to the West, even though I was trying to limit it, it stopped. He never taught me again. And rightly so. But alhamdulillah, there are others too. So I'll keep on going until only one remains. And then out of precaution, I have to stop. But these treatises exist. And they give 20-something reasons why Nisa emanates from this root in Arabic, delaying. One of them was this, that a woman, if she wants to be a woman, a true woman, a true Nisa, she doesn't disclose her beauty. She delays it until the halal person is found. She delays it. Prostitutes and the like who give themselves and their adornments very freely and very quickly, they are not Nisa in the Quranic sense. And these are the things which are important to know. Now you imagine this in all walks of life, all this reasoning why they are delayers. They have to know, and we have to teach them. But these treatises haven't been published yet for certain reasons. Some of them are very difficult to digest. Some of them, like this, are easier. But the words of the Quran, they're words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There's not only a zahiri aspect to it. Now, here we see, therefore, that Nisa is used horizontal to Salat. And therefore, here women can be seen as a means to ascension, one. And secondly, as a celestial being. Although men also have these dimensions, but now we're speaking about women here, that's another discussion. And in the Holy Quran, the logic of the verses of the Holy Quran is that whenever it speaks about attributes of perfection. Whenever it speaks about spiritual perfection, it's always about men and women. Min dhakarin o untha. It's always there. And therefore, when it comes to attributes of perfection, there's no difference. The potential to perfection exists in both. And Ibn Arabi, in one of his works, has said that if we had nothing but this one tradition, this meaning would easily be extrapolated from it, that the route to perfection is equal. And that is the tradition, إِنَّ النِّسَاء شَقَائِقُ الرِّجَالِ, that women are the shaqa'iq of men. Now, shaqa'iq in Farsi is a kind of flower. And actually, there was one scholar who translated it as such. But this is an Arabic tradition. And it has to be, you know, looked and interpreted in the Arabic way. And shaqa'iq means one's equal. When you chop a piece of wood into two, the two are shaqa'iq of one another, equals of one another. And Ibn Arabi says this alone is enough to prove, even if we had nothing else, no verses and no other traditions, that the route to perfection in men and women is equal, and all the states and levels of perfection that the man can acquire, the woman too can acquire. Even Ibn Arabi then says the status of Qutbiyya, the pole status. And this is a question that many people have. Can the woman be a spiritual mentor for men? And here, whilst many people may say no, Ibn Arabi says, why not? Spiritual mentor is to teach spirituality. And spirituality is from Allah. There can be no barring or hindering this process. And actually, Ibn Arabi had many female mentors. And in his Futuhat, when I researched it with the computer, searching particular terms, he speaks of four of those women. And actually, it's a very good read, but since we'll get diverted, it may take about 20 minutes, but I do have the actual text to read from. In all levels that the man can acquire, when it comes to attributes of perfection, so can the woman. In the traditions, when we go deeper in the traditions, this is all manifested. There are certain formulae of equilibriums that we see in the holy traditions of the Ahlul Bayt. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjal faraja. Kullama izdada al-abdu imana. However much the servant has increased in faith, in iman, izdada hubban lin-nisa, his love for women has increased. What does that mean? And this is a way of evaluating your iman. The more your love towards women has increased, the more your faith will be. It's an equilibrium here. Very, very easy. Why? Because here the woman is a conduit to iman. What does iman mean? A conduit to proximity towards Allah. Now, how can the woman be a source or a means for you to increase your iman? How can the woman be a means for your proximity to Allah to increase? Okay, I'll come to that in a minute. In other traditions, he says, "Kullu man ishtadda lana hubban ishtadda lin-nisa hubba." that however much or whoever has increased their love towards us, the Ahlul Bayt, they've increased their love towards women. Meaning, if your love towards women goes up, your severity of love for the Ahlul Bayt goes up. See, first it was Iman to Allah, now it's Ahlul Bayt, because there's no difference. Proximity to Allah is proximity to Allah's attributes. Proximity and love towards Ahlul Bayt are nothing but reflections and manifestations of Allah's attributes. That's why they're both used here. The meaning is the same. So the question is, what is it in the woman that makes her a conduit for one's iman and one's love towards the Ahlul Bayt to increase? And the answer, the way the Urafa have explained it, is that women manifest certain attributes of Allah more than men. They both manifest all attributes of Allah. Whatever is, from a speck of dust to the largest of things, whatever is manifests all attributes of Allah. Whatever is bears all attributes of Allah, be it a dust, mountain, animal, plant, because whatever is a manifestation of Allah. There has to be a synchronicity, harmony between the manifestor, Allah, Haqq, Creator, and the manifested creation. They're not mutually exclusive. This idea that there's Allah and nothingness, and then one day Allah from nothingness creates somethingness, it's a limited understanding of Allah. And one may be limiting Allah in the process. There has to be harmony between the Creator and the created. And therefore, whatever is created has all the attributes of the Creator. However, they manifest these attributes to varying degrees. The plant manifests it to X degree, the animal to Y degree, and humans to Z degree, and so on and so forth. Men and women have all attributes of Allah, but the woman manifests certain attributes more than the man. The man also attributes certain divine attributes more than the woman. Now, if the man focuses on these particular divine attributes that the woman possesses and manifests much more, it leads to his recalling Allah more and more. And the more one is present before Allah, recalling him, dhikrullah, the more one does that, the more one's iman increases, and the more one's love of Ahlul Bayt increases. What are those attributes that the woman manifests more than the man, and that the man should observe in the woman, even if she's non-practicing? Even if she's non-practicing. What are those attributes? One of those attributes is Ar-Rabb, the nurturer, the cherisher, the educator. But nurturer is the best, maybe. Ar-Rabb. The woman is a manifestation of Allah's rububiyyah. She nurtures. She nurtures in a way that a man can't nurture. A man, by seeing this, gets closer to Allah. She's only a means for recalling Allah. The man doesn't have this attribute as much. A man can't get close to Allah through another man. That's one of the wisdoms why homosexuality is a hindrance to perfection and not allowed in Islam. A man has to get to Allah through a woman. One of those attributes is her rububiyya, her nurturing. This we see mentioned in many traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, focusing on this nurturing capacity. And we see it when even looking at it from an aqli, a rational, philosophical angle. We believe in Islamic philosophy, there's a unity between body and soul. It's one reality. But this physical body is a subtle dimension and manifestation of an immaterial soul. But the soul is generating the physical body, moment to moment. And right now, this hand, legs, face, it's all the soul, but differing dimensions of it. It's in unity with the soul. My body is not mutually exclusive from my soul. And that's why when men and women who are not mahram to one another, when they make skin-to-skin contact, the soul is being contaminated, because there's a unity between body and soul. If the body was just like a piece of wood, the Sharia wouldn't have said you can't shake the hands of the opposite sex who are not mahram. The problem, or the main point is there's a unity here. You can't escape it. Yes, if you wear a glove, it's different. And the Sharia says it's different. You can go and shake because it's a glove. The glove isn't in unity with the soul. The glove isn't generated, isn't a manifestation of the soul. The same with women wearing the hijab. It's not to do with men being distracted or men being deviated. That's a very minor consequence, and the problem there is with the man. This is for the woman herself, the hijab. And when she's covering a certain part of the body, she's covering the soul. And that's why hijab leads to chastity. It's chastity of the soul. With men, the hijab is different. The man has to cover another part of the body, this part of the body. This has to be covered. The wisdoms behind it, I don't know. But it has to be covered. That's the hijab of the man. That's the chastity of the man. In these modeling magazines, you never come across a bearded man. Maybe once or twice, I don't know. There may be an exception. But usually they're without that part. Why? Even the modeling industry have concluded something from this. But there's a unity here. Now, the woman's body has a womb, a uterus. The man's body doesn't. Based on this principle of unity of body and soul, we see here that the soul of the two are varying, because the soul of one of them generated a uterus, but the soul of the other didn't. Even though they're both nurturers, but to differing degrees. But this is proof that she is a nurturer. And the essence of the woman lies in her nurturing capacity. And if we speak of the role of women in society, this nurturing capacity shouldn't be compromised. A woman who compromises her nurturing capacity is first of all compromising the relationship with the husband and the children, the family, and then society at large. No one is saying women should not work. They're free. No one is saying that. She can be a doctor, architect, engineer, any job. However, if this job is going to be a burden upon her and compromise her nurturing capacity, Islam enters the picture and says, be careful. Make sure your nurturing capacity as a nurturing teacher, architect, engineer, doctor, whatever, is not compromised. If that's nurturing capacity is going to be compromised, society will be compromised. And I'll read a quote from Imam Khomeini later about this. We have one tradition also which shows this point. And this is, again, one of those traditions which seem medieval at first, but the esoteric meaning is very important. إِنَّمَا مَثَلُ الْمَرَأَى مَثَلُ ذِلَعِ الْمُؤْوَجِ إِنْ أَقَمْتَهُ كَسَرْتَ وَإِنْ تَرَكْتَهُ إِسْتَمْتَعْتَ بِهِ إِسْبِرْ عَلَيْهَا. The example or parable of the woman is the example of a curved rib bone. You know, the rib bone is curved. The example of the woman is like the curved rib bone. Why? If you want to straighten it, referring to the curved rib bone, if you want to straighten it, it'll break. If you let it be, you'll benefit from it, from the rib bone. And at the end, it changes to the woman again. It says, Isbir alayha, be patient with her, let her be. Just let her be. Don't try to straighten her. She is free. Let her choose her destiny. If you want to straighten her, she'll break. If she breaks, the family will break. The family breaks, society breaks. You let her be and she will nurture, because that's the essence of the woman. She's a nurturer. Now, be it at home with children, that's a very noble deed also, but it doesn't have to be confined to the home. Even in society, she can nurture. But you let her be. This letting her be is reflected in the Sharia, in the rulings of the Sharia. Why does the man have to have 101 wajib duties under the umbrella of the nafaqah, maintenance? How did the woman feed herself before marriage? How did she clothe herself before marriage? How did she accommodate herself? What was her accommodation before marriage? How much did she travel before marriage? All these before marriage have to be maintained after marriage. Have to be maintained. Whatever it was, as a minimum, that much has to be maintained. By the man, though. By the husband. And that entails a whole list of wajib duties. When it comes to the man has to work, strive. And that's because he's reflecting certain attributes of Allah, which the woman doesn't manifest as much. But when it comes to the woman, she has no wajib duty to the man. Maybe one or two very small things. You see, this is reflected in the Sharia. Let her be. She'll nurture. But if you break her, no. That nurturing capacity, if that's going to be compromised, then the woman can't act womanly. And as a result, society will ultimately suffer. Other attributes also include her being a manifestation of the attribute Ar-Rahman. All merciful, the universally merciful. She manifests the mercy of Allah in ways that the man can't. And I'll come to that in a minute. Imam Khomeini has something very powerful there. And other attributes, her beauty and other things. One seeing the woman in this angle, it'll lead to one's proximity to Allah. Because you're constantly recalling Allah. You don't get sidetracked by any shortcomings that she may or may not have. And then, before marriage contracts, they read the very famous prophetic tradition that An-nikahu sunnati. The Holy Messenger said that nikah, marriage, is one of my customs, one of my customs. فَمَنْ رَغِبَ عَنْ سُنَّتِي فَلَيْسَ مِنِّي. And one who turns away from my customs is not one of mine. That's a very powerful utterance from the Holy Messenger here. In Islam, many things that existed, many transactions that existed before Islam came, 1400 years ago, Islam came and just signed its approval in relation to those transactions. Buying and selling, marriage and other things. Islam didn't change it essentially. Sometimes it came and changed certain things. Sometimes it came and prohibited certain things. But certain things Islam gave the green light and had no problem with and signed its approval, like buying and selling, like marriage. But when it comes to marriage, the Holy Messenger said, "An-nikahu sunnati." It's one of my customs. He never says buying and selling is one of my customs. How come all of a sudden with marriage, he made it specific to one of my customs? But with buying and selling and the other things that Islam signed its approval, no. There's no mention there. So it means here Islam has a particular outlook on marriage that other religions may not have had as much. Because here he's saying it's one of my customs. But previous religions had marriage. And here the philosophy of marriage becomes evident. That nikah is a form of tanakuh, intermingling between Allah's attributes. This is the philosophy of marriage. That the man recalls Allah through certain attributes that he can't through another man. The woman acquires proximity to Allah through certain attributes of the man, divine attributes of the man, which she can't through another woman. And it's this interplay of divine attributes which is important in marriage. Marriage is a holy endeavor, especially the permanent marriage. It should be looked with sanctity. It's a holy, sacred endeavor. It's all about getting closer to Allah. It's not an animalistic thing alone. That has some aspects in marriage. But looking at the woman qua animal is limiting Islam in a very bad way. That's only one dimension. So, when it comes to woman's role in society, be it her... That's not where... Oh, it's okay, yes. Something's... Oh, sorry. So when it comes to her role in society, her role, the thing which is important to bear in mind is that these attributes that constitute her identity, essence-wise, those attributes of her soul, they should not be compromised. That's the main message. It shouldn't be compromised. To the extent that these attributes are compromised in the woman, society's detriment and wretchedness will result. Then the Quran has one verse which is an incredible protocol of action. This verse explains one of the wisdoms behind why homosexuality is haram. However, when you go to its bottom, on the its prima facie meaning shows this. But when you go to its esoteric, botany meaning, it's underlying a protocol of action of how a man and woman should live, both individually at home and at large in society. It's a very delicate verse in the Holy Quran. It's chapter 7, and I've written here verse 81. Inshallah, it's right. إِنَّكُمْ لَتَأْتُونَ الرِّجَالَ شهوتن من دون نساء. That verily you're approaching, you men of the tribe of Lut, alayhi salam, you're approaching men shahwa wise and not women. These are Allah's words. If I'm emphasizing certain parts, there's a reason for it. These are Allah's words. Allah's words are multidimensional. The inner meanings are eternal. Allah is saying you're approaching men in the domain of shahwa. Here, on the superficial narrative of the story, it was a sexual shahwa. You men are approaching other men in the domain of shahwa, in that particular domain. And not women. See, this "and not women" is important. Meaning you have to do it with women in the superficial sense. And then it ends, "Bal antum qawmun musrifin." Musrifun it should be, yes. Musrifun. You are a people who are doing israf. You're wasting yourselves by this action. And society will be wasted. What are they wasting? How are they wasting? You see. Now, in the superficial sense, this is homosexuality, and it's a waste of the person and a waste of society. Because it's man and man. A lot is being wasted. The same applies with woman. However, when it comes to the inner meanings of the verse and the batini meanings, doesn't know of time and place. It's not limited to a certain area, a certain place, a given time. Here, when you look at this verse and take it in the absolute sense, which you're allowed to do when you want to approach the esoteric meanings of the verses of the Holy Quran, things become different now. In paraphrase, the verse becomes like this. O men, you're approaching other men in the domain of shahwa. Shahwa in the absolute sense though. Shahwa, one meaning of shahwa. Shahwa means tendency. It means that attraction, passion towards something. One misdaq and application of that is in that domain. But men, you're approaching other men in the realm of shahwa in the absolute sense. Not only in the animalistic, eating, sleeping and other aspects, but in your quest of knowledge, in your quest of work. This is also shahwa. It's also an attraction towards something, going towards something. You're in the domain of shahwa in the absolute sense. You're approaching other men, not women. You're a group that are wasters. You're wasting it. And look, so side by side, for a healthy society, men and women have to work. Their quest for work, their quest for knowledge, everything is together. At home, they do things together. It doesn't make any sense for a man who's married to go out late night with his friends, his male friends. That's not liked in Islam. Even shahwa in this sense of having a good night out, which is okay. You want to go to the cinema, you want to go to a restaurant, to the park. These are all forms of shahwa, halal forms. You want to do it? Yes. The Quran is saying, min dun nisa, without women. You're doing it with other men, but you have a wife. What are you going to achieve through another man there? You do it through women, you're wasting yourself. This is an important protocol to bear in mind. Now, first, let me say that me, myself, I don't act. Some things which I preach, I don't act upon them. And I have to be honest here. So don't think that I'm, you know, do everything I preach. At least the things I don't, I mention them. Scholars fall under this trap very easily. They think it's all about knowledge and learning and studying. The Imam's protocol was never this. Well, that's another discussion, inshallah, another time. But this is important. Everyone to their capacity, at least. No one's 100%. At least make an effort here. Marriage is a holy endeavor. And I'll end with two quotes from Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. One, in one he says, the woman is a grand human being, society's nurturer. Humans are discovered from the laps of women. After all, she is the educator of mankind. The prosperity and wretchedness of a given society depends on the existence and status of women. By correctly educating herself, she educates humans. And by correctly educating herself, she frees nations. The source of all prosperities emanates and springs from her lap. The woman must be the source of all prosperities. And somewhere else he says, the value of a single night of the mother with the child surpasses years of the responsible father's efforts. The embodiment of affection and mercy in the mother's luminous outlook is the manifestation of the mercy and affection of the Lord of all worlds, Rabbul Alameen. The Almighty Allah has blended the mother's heart and soul with the light of mercy of His, Allah's Lordship, to the extent that it can't be identified anywhere save within the mother. And He, Allah, has granted this eternal mercy to them for their heaven-breaking burdens from the time of conception, during gestation, during labor, during birth, and so on. The noble tradition that reads heaven lies under the mother's feet is referring to a reality. Such delicate wording is emphasizing the mightiness of the matter as well as warning children of the fact that they should seek prosperity and heaven from beneath the mother's feet, and they should observe their sanctity as they observe Allah's, and that they should seek their immaculate Lord's satisfaction through the satisfaction of their mothers. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala tahirin.